Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the What is in the Stimulus Bill and What Does It Mean for Your Hospital conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the one followed by the four on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, February the 25th, 2009. I would now like to turn the conference over to Lauren Solis from Premier. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Charmaine, and good afternoon from Charlotte to everyone that's joining us today on the Advisor Live telecast. I've got a few quick announcements before I turn the call over to Margaret Reagan. She's the Corporate Vice President for Premier's Advocacy Office in Washington, D.C. Following today's presentation, the operator will tell you how to ask questions. If you'd like to submit them offline or after the fact, you can find my email in the advertisement or email that you received about this call and send me notes and I'll try to get answers to you. After the call, you'll get a short email and it'll provide you with information on how to access all the materials from today's call. It'll also include a link to a brief survey. Your feedback is very important to us, so I'd really appreciate it if you could take about 2 to 3 minutes of your time and comment and give recommendations on future content. Again, thank you for participating today, and I'm going to now turn the call over to Margaret. Margaret?
Thank you. Hi, and welcome to everybody on our call today. We're going to be covering an awful lot of information. Oops. Everybody hear me? I think I just heard you there for a second. Let me start back up again and welcome everybody. We're going to be covering an awful lot of information in today's call. And based upon your feedback, we either have follow-up calls on whole or certain parts of the material discussed here today. So as a reminder, we'll be speaking from slides which can be found on the website. We also have a detailed summary of the healthcare provisions, a chart that attempts to explain the timeline, the law's implications, and a list of by state of funding for Medicaid FMAP formula. We also have the whole public law posted on our site. However, given the size of the law, I would not recommend printing it out. We plan to post a congressional version of the health sections only on the Advisor Live website and our advocacy website. This will also include a conference report that helps explain the congressional intent where possible. So let me introduce our speakers. First, we'll hear from John Furman with Health Policy Alternatives, the firm that specializes in evaluating and designing legislative and regulatory proposals. You will notice that HPA wrote the detailed summary available to you on the web. John joined HPA in 1991 after more than 16 years in California Healthcare Association. During the last 5 years with CHA, he was executive director where he managed the state and federal government relations programs. Next, you will hear from Pierre Persson, who is also with Health Policy Alternatives, who is both an attorney and a seasoned expert on Medicare and federal law programs. As the associate counsel for the Office of Legislation, I will not list every bit of piece of legislation he has helped craft it, but pretty much through the 90s, he did every Medicare, Medicaid, and drug-related bill you can think of. So if you don't like the drafting and have questions, you can follow Pierre afterwards. John and Pierre will cover the Medicare, Medicaid, and comparative effectiveness. Then we'll hear from Joe Lynch, partner from King & Spalding Healthcare Practice, which represents academic healthcare centers, health hospitals, health practice, e-commerce companies, managed care organizations, provider networks, and other healthcare providers. Joe will drill down on the HIP provisions of the bill. I will wrap up with a summary of the privacy provisions, and then we will open up the lines for Q&A. So thanks for joining us, and let's get started from hearing from John Furman.
Good afternoon. What we'd like to do in the time that we have available is Pierre and I will provide about a 30, 40,000-foot overview of the stimulus law that was signed into law on February 17th. It's now public law 111.5. It's the 111th Congress and the fifth law enacted by this Congress. Then we're going to turn it over to Joe Lynch, and he is going to drill down much closer as regards the health information technology provisions. And then we'll turn it back to Margaret, who will finish up with also a detailed review of privacy. Beginning with slide two, then, just to provide a quick overview, notice this is public law 111.5. It's $785 billion over 10 years, and every number we use here is going to relate to the 10-year time period. But this law provides that most of this money will be spent within the first 2 years, 2009 and 2010. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it should increase employment by 1.2 to 3.6 million individuals, both new jobs and retaining current jobs. There's a total of about $150 billion that will be spent in this bill for health-related issues. The implementation details are still being worked out. We've tried to identify what we know, what we think we know, in the outline. Also, the memo that Margaret referenced in her introductory remarks provides some greater detail about the possible implementation timelines for the various provisions, and I urge you to review this. And finally, this law, like most of the laws in the 111th Congress, they're going to be focusing more on transparency and accountability, and there we did provide you with a website address that you can go to for more information. Public Law 111.5 has two major sections. We're now on slide 3. There's Revision A, which is the appropriation provisions. It includes new funding for National Institutes of Health and other agencies. And then Division B, which has a number of issues related to tax, unemployment coverage, health, state fiscal relief, and other provisions. Turning to slide 4, talking about Division A and appropriation provisions. And in this part of the law, they provide additional funding. This is above and beyond what these agencies would normally receive in a normal annual appropriation process. The Health Resources and Service Administration, known as HRSA, is going to get about $2.5 billion. Most of this money will go for community health centers, which exist for access to low-income patients, and then about $500 million, half a billion, will be going for health profession workforce shortage education. There, the emphasis is going to be on primary care providers. The National Institutes of Health is going to get $10 billion. And we break it down how that's going to be distributed. $8.2 billion is going to the Office of the Director, but most of that, about $7.4 billion, is going to be distributed proportionally to the existing institutes as well as centers. So that, for instance, the National Institute of Mental Health, they're going to get about $350 million over 2 years. It's, you know, these centers, these institutes are going to have to use this money quickly. They're going to have to look for high-impact, short-term projects in order to move this money out of their respective centers. There's also going to be additional monies available for construction repair, and particularly biomedical and behavioral research facilities, and improvement repairs for National Institutes of Buildings and Facilities. Going to slide 5, appropriation provision still, there's going to be $50 million available for information security systems, and $1 billion available for preventive and wellness fund. Of that $1 billion, about $300 million will go to the Centers for Disease Control for immunization. There'll be evidence-based strategies addressing chronic care rates, state grants for hospital infection control strategies. And in all these cases, we won't know how this money will be distributed until within about 90 days after enactment, so 90 days after February 17th. We should have some better insights as to how this money is going to go. What I'd like to do now is turn it over to Pierre to talk about comparative effectiveness research.
Under the bill for comparative effectiveness research, there are two major provisions. One is funding in an aggregate amount of $1.1 billion over fiscal years 2009 and 2010 to three agencies within the government. And the second is the creation of the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research. Under the funding, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, $700 million is appropriated to the ARC for comparative effectiveness research under various provisions of law, under the Public Health Service Act, under Part A of Title 11 of the Social Security Act, and under Section 1013 of the Medicare Modernization Act. Unfortunately for the ARC, they have to transfer $400 million of that immediately to NIH. But of the funding for the ARC, that's $300 million, it is used to carry out three statutory authorizations that they currently have to conduct research. Under the Public Health Service Act, there is general research authority for the Public Health Service, and in this case the ARC, to do research into causes, treatments, and control and prevention of physical and mental diseases. It's a generic authority. Under Title 11 of the Social Security Act, specifically Part A of that title contains a series of provisions that relate generally to the Social Security Act, and more important to this purpose, it applies with respect to Medicare, Medicaid, and the state children's health insurance program. And under that part, there is authority for demonstration or demonstration projects or waivers, often referred to as Section 1115 waivers for the Medicaid program and others. And also under that part, there is a provision for research in healthcare outcomes, effectiveness, and appropriateness with a focus on the Medicare program. The concept there is to try to determine which diseases and health conditions can be most effectively and appropriately prevented, diagnosed, treated, or managed clinically. Section 1013 of the Medicare Modernization Act is a direction to the ARC to, again, conduct and support research on outcomes on comparative clinical effectiveness and appropriateness of healthcare items and services under the three federal health care entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and the State Children's Health Insurance Program. This provision under the Medicare Modernization Act is more interesting as it requires ongoing consultation with stakeholders, which appears to be absent from the earlier authorizations, and also provides for disseminations of findings to the managed care plans under the Medicare and Medicaid programs, as well as to the public. With respect to the ARC and the research they conduct, there is a generic prohibition on the agency from mandating anything that's considered to be a standard or clinical practice or quality health care standard, and there's also a rule of construction that applies generally to the agency that their findings are not to be construed as if they were mandates or clinical guidelines for payment, coverage, or treatment, which is of interest to a number of various health care industries out there. The National Institutes of Health, again, from that $700 million that was appropriated to the ARC, $400 is transferred to the NIH to conduct or support comparative effectiveness research. And that funding to the NIH goes into a special fund that's known as the Trans-NIH Research Fund. And this research fund is a source of funding for the NIH into important areas of emerging scientific opportunities that would benefit from research that involves collaboration between two or more national research centers or national centers. The $400 million left over that goes to the Department of Health and Human Services is $400 million for them to do as they see fit, to, quote, accelerate development and dissemination of research that assesses comparative effectiveness. The specific mandates on HHS here are that they are, in trying to accelerate that development and dissemination of research, they want to compare clinical outcomes, effectiveness, and appropriateness of healthcare items and services, compare procedures used to prevent, diagnose, and treat diseases, and encourage the development and use of clinical registries, clinical data networks, and other forms of electronic health data, which ties into some of the health information technology provisions that Sir Lynch will talk about shortly. So of that $400 million that's given to the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, a certain portion is to fund a report to the Institute of Medicine to come up with recommendations for priorities of that research. And taking that report as well as recommendations from this Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research that is established in this act, the Secretary will develop and fund, develop a list of priorities of that research and then fund it. Conditions generally of the funding is transparency, as John indicated earlier. HHS must publish information on the grants and contracts, must make it public. They must disseminate research findings to clinicians, patients, and the public as well. There are reporting requirements. The appropriators expect operating plans, and they want the first operating plan for fiscal year 2009 funding. They want that by July, the end of July, and they want the operating plans for fiscal year 2010 by the beginning of November. There are follow-up reports on funds that have been used, funds that have yet to be used, and how the department plans to use those funds, and those are semi-annual, the first one beginning November 1st, 2009. With respect to funding specifically, the $400 million that goes to the Department of Health and Human Services, There's a mandate that the Secretary take into account the considerations from the report in the Council that I mentioned earlier. Recipients of funds from the Department have to give the public an opportunity to comment on the research, and the conduct of research with this funding has to be consistent with Department policies on inclusion of women and minorities in research. The statement of managers, which is the expression of congressional intent, goes to some length to make it clear that comparative effectiveness research that is funded under this act, again, is not to be used to mandate coverage, reimbursement, or other policies for any payer, public, federal health care entitlement programs, or private. Under Section 804, the Act creates this Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research. And there, the effort there is essentially to foster coordination of the various comparative effectiveness research efforts of the agencies and departments of the federal government. So the Council is to assist departments and agencies to coordinate those efforts. The Council is also to advise the President and Congress on infrastructure needs of the agencies, and also to submit annual reports, including recommendations for infrastructure needs and organizational expenditures. Council is composed of 15 members who are senior officials of various federal health care departments and agencies, including the ARC, CMS, NIH, Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Defense, and at least half of those members must be physicians. The Council is also prohibited from mandating coverage, reimbursement, and other policies for any public or private payer, and any reports of the Council are not to be construed as any of those mandates or guidelines. And that's it for comparative effectiveness research.
Thank you. We'll come back, and when we take questions, we can come back and you can ask Pierre any questions you'd like on that section. Continuing on, though, with Division A, still in the appropriations, we come to the first section. This is slide number 7, having to deal with health information technology. And again, we'll be covering it only from about a 30,000 or 40,000 foot level, and Joe will be covering it in much more granular impact. But in the appropriations provisions, there is $2 billion authorized, appropriated for a number of activities that basically set up the system. These particular provisions do not relate to the payment incentives which are addressed in Division B. And there are a number of major elements or components in Division A. The first one is promotion of health information, and basically that sets up the structure. That sets up the National Council, the coordinator, it sets up the Standards Committee, and a variety of things. The next major section, the development and adoption of the standards themselves, lays out what these committees, what the agencies must do in the development of the standards. Then they talk about how these adopted standards can be used, the testing of these of the technology. And in grants and loan provision, they talk about funds that are available, some that are immediately available for information technology purposes. There's funds available for state grants. There's funds available to enhance higher institutions of education as regards technology. There's also major provisions related to privacy that Margaret will cover towards the end of this provision. And then finally, in provision B, there are payment for Medicare and Medicaid incentives. Moving to Division B, the first thing to talk about is the tax provision, and the tax provision of most importance would increase the marketability of tax-exempt bonds during 2009 and 2010. They allocated approximately $3.2 billion for this purpose, and the way they propose to do it is to ease the restrictions, if you will, on the use of interest expense for financial institutions. This will be effective for obligations issued on or after December 31st, 2008, which would be 2009 and 2010. Then there are two major provisions dealing with premium assistance, and this basically for the potentially uninsured. The first one has to do with Trade Adjustment Act health coverage improvements, and here they provide for an increased refundable tax credit for certain unemployed and pension recipients through December 31st, 2010. This provision is effective 60 days after enactment, so 2 months after the signing on February 17th. The bigger provision related to COBRA provides a subsidy, a 65% subsidy, for COBRA up to 9 months for fired workers and their families who fall below a certain income threshold. The threshold is $125,000 for individuals and $250,000 for families. They must be terminated during the period September 31st, 2008 through January 1st, 2010. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimates this may help up to 7 million Americans keep group health insurance coverage. Continuing on Division B, this is now slide 9, talking about the payment incentives for eligible professionals. They also talk about for hospitals, for Medicare. And we identified here some of the highlights that make these physicians available for coverage. One thing to point out is that while the eligible professionals include physicians as defined by Medicare, if the physician is hospital-based, that is, if the physician is a pathologist, a radiologist, what have you, who does most of his or her practice within the hospital, that physician is not eligible under this provision. If the physician shows that they have meaningful user of certified electronic health records, and that there are standards in the statute to help identify that, the physician can qualify up to $44,000 over 5 years. There are some penalties if you are not a meaningful user by 2015. There are certain penalties that will kick in, financial penalties. And if by 2018 the secretary determines that 75% or less of physicians have meaningful users of electronic health records, the secretary can impose additional penalties. But that's the discretion of the secretary. And there are some reporting requirements. Turning to page slide number 10, talk about incentives for hospitals. These are Medicare participating inpatient hospitals and critical access hospitals. Again, the term meaningful user of certified electronic health records is used here. There are standards in the statute that help identify who they are, and the secretary is given discretion to determine who is and who isn't a meaningful user. There's a payment formula that drives the amount of money available to each hospital. Basically, that formula has a $2 million base, and then it's a function of discharges up to a certain level. And this, again, would be determined by the secretary, by the agency. For critical access hospitals, they have more lenient payment opportunities. They can expense their entire electronic health purchase costs in a single year rather than use the depreciable schedule. Again, there are payment penalties if the hospital does not have a meaningful user of certified EHRs by 2015. And there are no payments that would happen after 2016. And then in Medicaid, again, there are payment incentives for qualified health professionals. There are a number of them. They have to provide at least 30% Medicaid by volume. They're limited in terms of how much they can be paid the first year, the $25,000, and then over the next 5 years, at $10,000 for each year. For hospitals, children's and acute care hospitals with at least 10% Medicaid volume would be eligible. They use the same Medicare formula to determine how much is paid, except in the use of Medicaid, they use Medicaid data, Medicaid days. And in the statute, they said that CMS would publish the health information technology amount for each eligible hospital. And I haven't seen when that's going to become available. Continuing on to slide 12, talking about extension of certain moratoriums on certain Medicare regulations. One has to do with the delay in the phase-out of Medicare hospice wage index budget neutrality adjustment. That's a benefit of about $134 million for hospices. But this is only for fiscal year 2009. The conference report language assumes that hospices and CMS will work out the difference in the regular rulemaking cycle. There's also be a delay in the phase out of the indirect medical education capital adjustment factor. But again, this is also for just 2009. It doesn't stop it. It just delays it. It prevents the 2009 phase out, but it would allow continuing if that is what CMS wants to do. That's an additional saving to hospital of about $191 million. And finally, there's a long-term care hospital technical correction that saves, I say 12, some people have said $13 million. This is a technical correction basically trying to align the various effective dates having to do with the proposed threshold in terms of what hospitals I mean, hospitals within a hospital, long-term care facilities, satellite long-term care facilities can accept discharges from co-located and non-co-located hospitals. Going on to slide 13 on state fiscal relief, the stimulus package includes about $87 billion over 2 years to provide state relief. The payment periods run from October 1, 2008 through December 31, 2010. There are basically three relief components to this Medicaid provision. One would hold all states harmless from any drops in their FMAP percentage. According to some individual reports I've seen, reportedly there are 16 states that would benefit from this. The next applies to all states. Every state would receive a 6.2% increase in their FMAP percent over the course of 2 years, 6.2%. These two provisions account for about 65% of the total $87 billion over 2 years that Congress has authorized. And finally, the last component, which accounts for about 35%, would provide bonuses for states with relatively high growth and unemployment rates. And this would vary by states, and they could look at, they use BLS statistics to look at the differences for three consecutive months of high and three consecutive months of low to come up with this percentage. As a condition to receive this, the states cannot reduce their eligibility from July 1, 2008. If they do, states can qualify for it, but only after they adjust their eligibility to the level that it was prior to July 1, 2008. And the provision also includes a prompt pay payment. Right now, there is a prompt pay current law provider for certain professionals. The statute extends this prompt pay requirement to skilled nursing facilities and to hospitals. It requires that for just under the statute, it doesn't extend it permanently, it's just under the stimulus package. The secretary is given the authority to waive this prompt pay requirement. For hospitals and skilled nursing facilities, it wouldn't kick in until July 1st, 2009, and the prompt pay requirement is only applicable to claims that are filed since the enactment of this stimulus bill. There are some additional Medicaid and other provisions that the Division B includes. One is the continuation of the disproportionate share hospital payment, 2.5% in 2009 and 2010, an extension of moratorium on certain Medicaid final regulations. These are ones that had been adopted earlier by statute. They've extended them a little bit to July 30, 2009. There are a number of other ones we identify here in the slide. This is slide 14. The sense of Congress is that these should not be published in final form. There are a number of provisions regarding extension of certain programs to provide relief for low-income individuals. One is the extension of the work-related transitional medical assistance program, and that should be through December 31st, 2010, not through 2009. And an extension of the qualifying individual program through 2010, and a protection of Native Americans under the Medicaid and SHIP programs. Let me stop here, and again, to pass on the questions until the end and turn it over to Joe for the details under the health Information Technical Program.
Thanks, John. I want to start off with an important ground rule on my part of the presentation, and that ground rule is that if I am going to say anything funny at all, I'm going to try to telegraph that in advance, and then I'm going to assume that everyone on the call is laughing uproariously at what I said. And that's going to make me feel better making this audio conference presentation. As John said, I want to drill down a little bit on the HIT provisions. There's a couple of slides that John went over earlier in the presentation that talk about the provisions for qualifying for the HIT funding. I'm not going to repeat the information in those slides, but as you all know, there's going to be incentive payments under Medicare and Medicaid for PPS hospitals and critical access hospitals. If you don't qualify as a meaningful EHR user by federal fiscal year 2015, you're going to start getting penalties assessed against you. I think you also may know that there is funding available for a new type of entity referred to as a Health Information Technology Regional Extension Center. I'm a little fearful that those are going to start being called HITRECs. but maybe someone can come up with a better acronym. Those, I believe, are going to be what is now referred to as Regional Health Information Organizations, or RIOs for short, and I'm going to come back to that later in my remarks. And then finally, John touched on the fact that for physicians who are not hospital-based physicians, they will also be entitled to incentive payments, and I emphasize this because I know that many of you have affiliated physician practices, and you hospitals and critical access hospitals and academic medical centers that have affiliated physician practices, you will be able to help the physicians in those practices qualify for incentive payments and also avoid the penalty payments that will apply if they don't qualify. So I know you're familiar with those high-level elements of the stimulus legislation. As John said, I want to drill down a little bit and focus on what you need to do to access the money that's available. And my overarching point for this part of the presentation is you need to start now. If you've looked at some of the summaries on the stimulus legislation, you will see that the first year that incentive payments are available are not until 2011. You may also have seen that if you qualify after fiscal year 2013, you will be entitled to a lesser amount of incentives. I think that thinking about those time periods, it's easy to say, I've got a lot of time to get ready for this, particularly since, as John said, we don't even have regulations issued yet that really clarify what is necessary to qualify. But I want to emphasize to you that I don't think that you have the time now to sit back. I think you need to start preparing now, and I want to try to point out a couple of things that I think everyone needs to start doing to be ready. Let's start with slide 16. You'll see on that slide the excerpts from the legislation on what it means to be a meaningful EHR user. Parenthetically, this is basically the same definition for PPS hospitals as it is for physicians. I've identified in italics some of the key elements of what it means to qualify as a meaningful EHR user. You have to be using certified EHR technology. You have to be using that technology in a meaningful manner. That EHR technology has to be connected for electronic exchange of health information. And you need to be using this EHR technology in the EHR reporting period that's applicable to the year for which you get incentive payments. Now, if that's not crystal clear to everybody, you shouldn't be too upset about it because no one on the planet knows what any of that means. And we will not know what that means until the Secretary of HHS issues regulations that clearly define each of the italicized words that are on this slide. Parenthetically, one of the other requirements to be a meaningful EHR user is that you will have to be reporting to the Secretary your performance in connection with quality measures yet to be established, and you'll need to do that reporting through electronic transfer of information unless the Secretary is not capable of receiving that information electronically. It is a little ironic that Congress chose to put that latitude in for the Secretary in a bill that's designed to promote the expansion of electronic transfer of information. So flipping over to slide 17, let's focus for a second on what we know for sure about what it means to qualify as a meaningful EHR user. As I said a moment ago, the earliest payment year for which you can qualify for HIT incentives is federal fiscal year 2011. So that means for hospitals whose fiscal years begin on or after October 1st of 2010, that's the period for which you could first qualify for payments if you are a meaningful EHR user. So we know that that's the starting point. We also know that if you don't start qualifying as a meaningful EHR user until after federal fiscal year 2013, so in other words, after September 30th, 2013, you're not going to get the full benefit of all the incentive payments you could otherwise qualify for. Third thing is, we know you've actually got to be using EHR technology. And although using is not defined, you're going to have to show that you're using it. And you're going to have to show that you're using it in the EHR reporting period. Now, the term EHR reporting period is not defined in the statute, but the Secretary of HHS is authorized to come up with regulations specifying what it is. And I want to come back in just a second and touch on that. And then finally, we know you're going to have to be connected. We don't know what connected means, but in order to qualify for the incentive payments, you've got to be connected. So let's flip over to slide 18 and talk about what I think some of these words are going to be defined to mean. So first, using. Using EHR technology, I can guarantee you it's going to be something more than just trying to get it up and running. There's another part of the stimulus legislation which uses the phrase that's italicized here in point number one, a hospital engaged in efforts to adopt, implement, or upgrade certified EHR technology. That is not what using is going to mean. If using was going to mean that, Congress would have defined it as such. And so you're going to have to actually be doing something real with your EHR technology. Second is, I am convinced that the term connected is going to mean far more than just being able to share information electronically within your own hospital or within your own family of related enterprises. It's going to mean that you've got to be connected somehow with others in the community, other third parties in the community. Third is, I mentioned a second ago that the Secretary has the authority to define what it means, what this term EHR reporting period means. EHR reporting period is the period in which you're going to have the data to demonstrate that you are a meaningful EHR user. Since the first year that incentive payments can be paid is federal fiscal year 2011, it stands to reason that the earliest EHR reporting period for federal fiscal year 2011 will be some period prior to October 1st of 2010. And it may in fact be a reporting period longer than a single year. So that's part of the reason why I said a moment ago, now is the time to start, because the data you're going to have to be submitting to demonstrate you're a meaningful EHR user is data that is potentially going to be generated next year. Finally, and point four is that since you're going to have to demonstrate through data that you're using and connected, the data you'll be submitting is likely to be a year or two old when you submit it. And so that further reinforces my point that now is the time to start getting on board with being a meaningful EHR user. Finally, the term certified EHR technology also isn't defined. My guess is that since Congress very much wants to get this stimulus money out as fast as possible, that at least in the early years, EHR technology that is in the market today is going to be deemed to be certified. I think you all probably are generally aware that the EHR technology that is in the marketplace today has actually, the vendors have made a lot of progress in terms of the interconnectivity and interoperability of that software. There actually are already some leaders in that area. I've got to believe that the Secretary of HHS is going to, at least in the short run, determine that what's in the marketplace today is going to meet the standard. I don't think that's going to be the case over time. I think the standards are going to get more rigorous. So flipping over to the slide on page 19, I just want to think about the implications of all this. For the hospital clients that I'm working with, I'm saying to them, you have got to be a meaningful EHR user no later than October 1, 2013. If you don't meet that date, you're just leaving money on the table. You've got to start today getting organized.
You think it's not that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please continue to stand by. Your conference call will resume shortly.
Difficulties. Perhaps we should be applying for some stimulus funding as well. I apologize for that. We've been told by the operator that the line was cut off, I think, right after I made the point that if you don't qualify as a meaningful EHR user by 2013, you will be leaving money on the table. I think the only other points that I made until we learned we had been cut off are that you're going to have to start focusing now on the data that you'll be using to demonstrate that you're using EHR technology and connected for purposes of meeting the definition of meaningful EHR user. If you are trying to meet the deadline of October 1st, 2013 to maximize your incentive payments, that probably means you're going to be using data from 2011, maybe 2012, and so as I said earlier in the call, now is the time to start getting ready so that you'll be able to have that data to submit it to be qualified as early as possible. So let's flip over to slide 20. I do think that there's a terrific opportunity available in the stimulus legislation to assist you in getting ready to be a meaningful EHR user, and in particular, to meet the connected requirement. I think it's going to be impossible in most geographic markets to satisfy the connected requirement of being a meaningful EHR user. I think it's going to be impossible to do that, or at least very, very difficult, if you don't have a regional health information organization established in your market. As I said earlier in the call, these extension centers, these HITRECs, I believe is what Congress is envisioning as being the RIO. It seems clear to me that a RIO should be able to qualify for the money that's available for these centers. And it's not an insignificant amount of money. The amount of money that these centers can qualify for is up to 50% of their capital and operating costs for up to 4 years. In my experience, two of the key difficulties in organizing a RIO are, one, getting people to feel comfortable sharing information, and two, ponying up the money that's necessary to actually get the infrastructure off the ground. So if you can defray 50% of your operating and capital costs right up front, that is money worth going for. John mentioned in his comments that the Secretary is going to start issuing regulations on this law within 90 days following the passage date, so 80, 85 days from now. The legislation specifically directs the secretary in the first round of regulations to announce what it's going to take to qualify as one of these extension centers, how much money is available, what you need to do to apply, and so I think that is a top priority for every institution to be focusing on those regulations, so you'll be at the head of the line to get the money, to be an extension center, and thereby facilitate your complying with the meaningful EHR user requirements as quickly as possible. Flipping over to slide 21, I mentioned early on that the hospitals with affiliated physician practices are also going to have access to the money that's available for non-hospital-based physicians. Now, the legislation, like many of the other provisions we've talked about, the legislation is not completely clear as to who is a non-hospital-based physician and what the circumstances are going to be qualifying for that money in a case where there is, for instance, a group practice that is affiliated with a hospital but not billing using the hospital's billing number and not using the hospital's equipment and electronic health records technology. Regulations will clarify that, but for the hospitals that have affiliated physician groups, one of the things I want to point out to you is you are going to need to decide whether you're going to go after the Medicare incentive for physicians or the Medicaid incentive for physicians. Unlike the case under the hospital incentives, where you can qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid incentives, on the physician side, you have to choose. The dollar amounts are not wildly different between what the maximum amount is under Medicare, which is $44,000 over 5 years, versus under Medicaid, a little north of $63,000. It's not wildly different, but the way the legislation is written, it appears, and once again, not completely clear, but it appears that you could start qualifying for the Medicaid money immediately. You're not going to get the physician Medicare incentive money until the earliest in 2011, fiscal year 2011. But you may be able to get the Medicaid money earlier than that because there's no first year listed in the legislation for the Medicaid money. So once again, for hospitals that have affiliated physician practices, I think you need to start looking now at whether you want to take the Medicare money or the Medicaid money. Qualifying for the Medicaid money is not all that easy. As John said, you have to have a minimum level of patient volume seen by the physician. As a general matter, that's at least 20% Medicare patients. For pediatricians who are not hospital-based, 30% for other non-hospital-based physicians. If you have physicians that are practicing mainly at a federally qualified health center or a rural health clinic who have at least 30% Medicaid, patients, needy patients, or patients covered by the child health care program, you will be able to qualify for the Medicare or Medicaid incentive. So that basically wraps up my remarks. I just want to close with 2 points. One, as I said at the outset, my main focus was start now. I can't emphasize that strongly enough. Two is, I know that we've covered a lot of technical information here. We're going to open it up for questions after Margaret talks about privacy, but I want to tell everyone that if you have questions about anything that I've said, I want you to feel free to get in touch with Premier. They'll direct you to me, and if you just tell me you've been on this call, I'll be happy to answer any question you raise at no charge. So with that, Margaret, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Joe. Well, I have the great task of actually now that they've laid out where all the money is and how you can grab it, I'm focusing on the challenges that go along with taking that money. And if you look on the first slide, really dealing with some of the privacy provisions, I'm really going to cover 6 of them. As you know, there are more there. If you are a security or privacy officer, obviously you need to dig in a little bit deeper on these issues. But let me just start by saying that overall, when this legislation was on the Hill in the House and Senate version, it had many more provisions than what we actually see here in the law. And one of the biggest victories we had, we're part of a larger coalition working on this called the Privacy Coalition, we were able to actually get out in the conference report a provision that would have opened up a review of all the healthcare operations and decided what needed consent or authorization by a patient. So with that dropping, let me just cover the first top six that I think will be somewhat of a challenge for us, in which Premier will be seeking your help as these regulations come out. The first one is the breach requirements. I think you all know in the pool of transparency, the Hill is very concerned, since HIPAA has been put in place a few years back, that there wasn't enough information going out to patients if their data had been released. And I know many of you have seen many of the press horror stories, unfortunately a lot of it by the government itself, on how this data was released publicly and that the folks didn't know until months later. So you can see from our slides in here and a detailed summary about all the different ways you have to notify patients about releasing personal identified health information that's protected. So they will be noticed either by written, mail, and if it's over a certain percentage, over 500, you actually have to report to the secretary. And if you can't find them by mail, then you actually have to have it hosted by either a toll-free number or actually put on a website. Now, some people may think this is a little bit overkill, and they do have some exceptions in here. Let me just point out to you on the next slide that we have on page 25. I'm going to jump down to the regulation process. Now, one of the things that we did ask for the legislation to include, which they didn't, but we hope to have in the regulation itself, is to only notify patients of breach if actual harm intended. So if you think of the different ways that breach can occur, do you have to notify when it was unintentional and you didn't really hurt anybody, and what's the point of putting something on the website or trying to track someone down by mail? So that is a comment period that we're really going to need a lot of focus on if we can get the harm element included into the regulation itself. That will be coming up in August of 2009, so it's one of the first things we're going to have to deal with. But before that, they are going to be issuing guidance. I want to point out to you what is actually secure for personal health information, or protected health information, rather. That will be coming up in April. And then going forward, Congress will actually receive a report from the Secretary on this issue. Now, moving on to the Caring for Disclosures, which is on page 26 on your slide, this is another big piece. Again, one of the things that he'll really want to focus in on is transparency and the access to information. And if you will notice, we had this long discussion about IT. Let me just point out right off the top that one of the things they're really counting on this IT to do in our discussions on the Hill is actually be able to pull out data for patients at a flip of a switch and turning it over so people can get all kinds of information about who's actually accessed their data. Now, I know a lot of our IT systems really can't do that currently, and so this is sort of like a pyramid scheme in a way. HHS and the IT section says they have to issue regulations by December of 2009. So from there, once that's out for technical standards, then from there they will issue regulations on the accounting for disclosure section. So a lot of it's counting on this new technology to be able to make the world easier for accessing patients for disclosures. Now, as you all know, in the current law, it is for non-routine disclosures. This would be for routine and non-routine disclosures of health information, which is a huge difference. So in there, in the regulation process, we're really looking for help from you all when the time comes, because we need to focus on the administrative burden of this. We do believe patients should have a right to access information and disclose where possible, but we do need to take account of what they really do need, and we really need to take an account into, you know, what is really viable for us in the sense of making technology work and not being such a burden if it comes to great administrative piece on that. Now, on the next piece, on page 527, we're talking about the limited data set. This is an issue for those of you around the first time around talking about the HIPAA issue, is how much information do people really need? So by August of 2010, a year and a half from now, they really want to have by that date something out there to say what is a limited data set guidelines. Again, this is a year and a half from now, but this debate going back is how much information does someone need when caring for someone or paying up for payment and other types of issues. Now, on the next slide, let me just focus in on something that is, again, something that's always been kicking around for quite some time, is dealing with the access to information from a patient point of view. I think that you all know that it's a good thing to be able to give patients their information, but they did put in here the requirement that you actually have to do it, and it can't be more than labor costs for doing so to be able to get the protected health information. And on the next slide, we focus on the fundraising. It's been kicking around for a while as well. You will be required, starting a year from now, on February 17th, to actually put in any of your communications, an opt-out and very plain upfront piece, not maybe at the bottom of the page, but saying if you don't want communications dealing with fundraising through your organization, you will actually have to, you can have the right to opt out. And let me make a point on the enforcement, the law enforcement, the last slide. This, again, is a major change in the sense that one of the biggest critics of the original HIPAA regulation is that there wasn't enough law enforcement oversight of this. And so now, in only addition to the federal government, but we do have the state's attorney general is also able to sue on behalf of their residents for going after organizations that actually don't follow the HIPAA guidelines. And this will cover providers as well as the business associates. Now, I know most of you are providers on the call, but you want to be thinking about your business associates and how this works, because they're going to be under the same enforcement, they're going to be under the same penalties that you all are facing now, and a lot of these business associate agreements probably will have to be rewritten and reviewed again, so you all should take a close look at that as well. So let me stop that right now and turn to the operator and putting it up for Q&A.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you'd like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question comes from the line Patsy Barker with Lincoln County Medical Center. Please go ahead with your question.
Okay, I have two questions. One is, as we talked about this, we've listed PPS hospitals, but then you did talk about some of these things applying to critical access hospitals. I'm a critical access hospital, and I want to know, does all of this apply to us equally, or what will the differences be? And then my second question was, and I'll voice that later. I'd like to hear the answer to this one, please.
The only place where critical access hospitals are mentioned in the stimulus bill has to do with Medicare payment incentives. And there they get some leniency in terms of how they can depreciate the cost of the acquisition of electronic health records and the related equipment and training and so on and so forth. To my knowledge, I don't think they're referenced anyplace else in the stimulus package.
John's right. There's they are included in both the incentive, the HIT incentive payments that they can qualify for, and they will also be subject to the HIT penalties if they don't qualify. My sense is that as many gaps as there are in the legislation with respect to the HIT provisions and what they mean with regard to PPS hospitals, there's even more gaps with regard to what it means for critical access or critical access hospitals.
The one thing on critical access hospitals, we mentioned what they can do in terms of depreciation in a single year for the equipment purchases. But in order to qualify for the payment incentives, they have to have, I think, at least 1,500 Medicare discharges.
Okay.
So I don't know what your discharge status is, but the payment relief is $200 for a discharge from 1,500 up to 23,000 or something like that. And there's no additional benefit if you go above that number. So you have to have at least 1,500.
Okay.
And what was your second question?
I think they clarified it on 21. My worry was we have a majority of hospital-based physicians. We're a small town, small rural town, and there's one hospital in town, and so probably 85% of our physicians are what we consider hospital-based. And I was kind of confused as they... At first I thought they were working something out for both the non-affiliated and the affiliated, but then on 21 it seemed like it was saying the hospital-based physicians were not included in any of this, or are they going to get some help?
Yeah, let me take a crack at clarifying that. What I think Congress intended to do is to say for radiologists, anesthesiologists, and pathologists who by and large work in the hospital, use the hospital facilities, don't really have their own overhead. I think Congress was trying to avoid double dipping.
All right.
The way that the definition of hospital-based physician is drafted, though, it's a little unclear how it's going to apply to circumstances, for instance, where a hospital itself employs primary care physicians, hospitalists, specialists who deliver services through the hospital, but there are additional hospital overhead items that relate to those physicians because they all have office practices, they have equipment that are in their offices, they're not qualitatively like radiologists, anesthesiologists, and pathologists.
Right.
So this is one where I'm expecting that the regulations will give greater definition to which physicians who are affiliated with hospitals can qualify and which can't. As a minimum, I think that a physician who is affiliated with a hospital but who is employed through an entity other than the hospital itself, I think that kind of physician, like it, for instance in a friendly professional corporation or a hospital controlled group practice, that kind of physician I think will be able to qualify for the HIT incentive payments.
The statute provides, it says, when it talks about hospital-based professionals, it says, such as pathologists, anesthesiologists, and emergency physicians, who furnish substantially all, that's the end of the quote, of his or her services in quote, a hospital setting, whether inpatient or outpatient, and through the use of facilities and equipment of the hospital, close quote. So it seems like, you know, if it's a site of service issue, it just depends on where the service is provided. If substantially all of the physician's services are provided within the hospital, and the hospital supports the physician, that physician will be deemed to be hospital-based. But if it's not provided entirely within the hospital, even though there's a contractual relationship between the hospital and the physician, that physician will probably be eligible. But as Joe says, we'll probably need to wait for the regulations.
Okay. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of David Durbin with SMS Healthcare. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. On the years about the eligibility for health IT incentives, and I understand the first payments won't be available until federal fiscal 11, and you mentioned the hospital's fiscal year, and then there's also this reporting year that the secretary will be establishing. Let's assume we have a hospital who is already, let's say, using one of the systems that's been certified under the old regime and whatnot. How would you see that reporting year fitting in with the fiscal year and the hospital's fiscal year?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great question, and let me try to give you a concrete example. So, as you all probably know, there's an established regional health information organization that's up and running in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't know the specifics of what's going on there, but I'm going to assume that they're exchanging information electronically, and so therefore, in almost any set of circumstances, the providers in that community would meet the meaningful EHR user definition.
Right.
So here's the way the different terms would work. The secretary has to determine what is the EHR reporting period. That's going to be some period prior to October 1st, 2011. And for Indianapolis, it's going to reach back to whatever period where they can demonstrate that they have been doing this. So they're not gonna have my guess is, my very strong guess is that they're not gonna have trouble getting incentive payments at the outset. And the earliest point at which they'll be able to get incentive payments on the Medicare side is the beginning of each of their, the hospitals, each of their respective fiscal years, which begin on or after October 1, 2010, which is federal fiscal year 2011.
Right.
So the EHR reporting period is just the, that's the period that you focus on for the data you use to demonstrate that you're a meaningful EHR user.
All right, and then going forward, let's assume that a hospital's fiscal year is the calendar year, and let's assume that in the in December of 2011, that a hospital becomes a meaningful user, connected, all those kinds of good things. Do they, would they then begin to get payments beginning in January the following year? Is that for
I think that's a reasonable guess.
Okay.
But we're not going to know the answer to that for sure until the secretary defines what the EHR reporting period is.
Understood.
So, just something that I would be very surprised by is, in your example, if a hospital was able on the very first day of December in 2011, or 2010 rather, was able to say, okay, today we're meeting all the requirements of meaningful EHR user. I would be very, very surprised if that hospital would actually get incentive payments in federal fiscal year 2011. Because I think that there's going to be a meeting that definition, I think you're going to have to show data over some period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's probably the beginning of the next federal fiscal year that that hospital would likely start qualifying. And maybe maybe the provider community will be fortunate and the secretary will be very lenient in terms of what has to be submitted, but I think you've got to assume the opposite.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is we're multi-hospital, multi-state organization, frankly, with a proven record in at least five of our hospitals, and as we roll it out to additional hospitals, gee, I mean, we've shown that the system works. It's just one more hospital that we've rolled it out to, if you see what I mean.
I do, and once again, it's a great example. I think Margaret mentioned in her remarks about the importance of you weighing in with Premier when these draft regulations come out. I think that that would be a perfect comment for Premier to submit on behalf of the member hospitals, because there are many, many Premier hospitals that are in that, they're going to be in that exact situation.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Charles Hart with Regional Healthcare. Please proceed with your question.
Yes. Do you have any idea if there are incentives built into this in terms of the clinics versus the hospitals? Like, I mean, I could see just a real Tower of Babel being developed out here. We've got a tremendous number of private practices, and then we've got our hospital, and if they all go out, each one of them gets a different certified EMR. Is there any incentive in here to have the physicians work with their local hospital or hospitals?
Just off the top, I think there are. I mean, they have to identify, as Joe was saying, that they're connected and that they're using the electronic health records. And I think that they're going to go beyond just something they do internally. They have to be able to reach out. And I think one of the tests may be the relationships between the clinics, if you will, or the freestanding physician offices and the respective hospitals, and they need to be able to communicate. And if they have different systems, they can't communicate, or they wouldn't be able to do it optimally. So I think there would be, I mean, just intuitively, I think there'd be some incentives built in that there'd be a coordination in terms of the establishment of these electronic health record systems. Joe?
Let me, I agree with what John just said. Let me point out what I think a couple practical issues are with respect to that question. First is, the amount of money that a physician can qualify for on the Medicare side, the outline says it's a maximum of $44,000. It is, though, also a function of how big a Medicare practice the physician has. And some of my clients have already, some of my physician clients have already started saying to me, you know, we're not going to get the $44,000 for some of our physicians because the nature of their practices are such that they don't have a high Medicare population. And so in some communities with physician groups who are, say, multi-specialty and they have a mix and many of the physicians don't have a high Medicare population, those physician groups, I think you can expect them to be looking for financial help, because they're not going to get the full incentive payment. So that's one practical consideration here. Another practical issue is, as you might imagine, this legislation is not exactly a boondoggle, but it certainly is something really nice for the vendor community. The vendor community is going to do very, very well financially on the basis of this legislation. They are going to make completely sure that their technology is certified EHR technology and is completely interfaceable with all of the major EMRs that are out there. Now, there's a lot of offices that have esoteric EMRs that are not off the rack, and the interfaceability with those EMRs is going to be an open question. But I think the vendor community is going to solve a lot of the connection issues because it's going to be in their financial best interest to do so.
Do you know, can the physicians take advantage of the Stark exception also?
Yes, they can.
So they can
Yes, that's a great question, and the answer is yes, they can. And I fully expect that in many communities, physicians will be looking to get financial assistance from hospitals under the Stark exception that permits the hospitals to provide it.
So can that, I guess the monies, can they get not only these monies that came out with the stimulus bill, but also the hospital paying them that 85%?
You know, there is one, and this is something where you may need to get back in touch with me or Margaret to get a definitive answer on that question. There is a provision of the statute that doesn't allow double dipping, but I think it actually is in the Medicaid side of the physician incentive payment. I don't think it's on the Medicare side. I apologize for not knowing that off the top of my head, but I believe the answer to your question is a physician who is getting HIT incentive payments on the Medicare side could also get the financial benefit that's permitted under the Stark exception.
Very good. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of George Connor with Mercy Health Partners. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, my question is with reference to the connected portion of the presentation and the REALS and Health Information Exchange. Will there be a definition of what is a certified, if you will, REAL or Health Information Exchange with reference to connected? Because I know they can take different shapes, governance, for-profit, non-profit, etc.
There will be a definition of what is one of these health information technology regional extension centers, which, as I say, I think that is what the RIOs are going to become by and large. That definition is going to be issued by supposed to be issued by the Secretary of HHS within 90 days after the passage date of the legislation. The conference committee report on these extension centers says that they have to be affiliated with a nonprofit entity, a tax-exempt charitable entity. And I think what's actually going to happen is these extension centers themselves are going to be tax-exempt organizations.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Andrew Gonti with Workflow IT Solutions.
Please proceed with your question.
Hi. Just want to ask whether the law differentiates between for-profit versus non-profit hospitals. In other words, whatever benefits are available for non-profits can also be extended to the for-profit hospitals. Am I correct?
You're talking about health information technology provision.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
There's no distinction between for-profit and non-profit.
But right. There is in the Medicaid part, I believe.
Non-profit?
No? Well, I thought in the Medicaid part in states it had to go to non-profit entities, but maybe I'm wrong there.
Why don't we check that
we'll
confirm that.
Okay, appreciate that. Thank you.
And there are no further questions at this moment. I'll turn the call back to you.
Well, thank you, operator. Let me just point out one other thing I forgot to mention at the beginning of all the items on our web site. We also have a calculator that you can pull down to figure out the sort of rough estimate there of what you might be getting for incentive payments for the HIT section of it. So if you are interested, please go to the website to pull down a calculator. And let me, at that point, thank everybody. Oh, Matt, do you have a question? Okay, sorry. So we had a question here in the room, but I think it was answered earlier. So with that, let me turn it back to Lauren.
Thanks, Margaret, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call today. Sorry about the little technical difficulties, but that happens. Again, look for an email coming out from me in the next few hours, and it'll give you instructions on how to access all these materials. And also, my contact information will be in there, so if you have questions that we didn't get to today, you can send them to me, and I'll make sure they get addressed. Please take a couple minutes and fill out the survey. We welcome your thoughts and ideas about future content for Advisor Live. If the speakers could just stay on the line, I'd like to say goodbye to everyone else and have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.